Los Angeles sunshine coming through.
Please stand by. Prime Video and Westworld director Jonathan Nolan invite you to Fallout.
After 200 years, we don't know much about what's up there. Violence, desperation, lawlessness.
Everyone wants to save the world, they just disagree on how.
We're gonna get across that wasteland, and we're gonna do it together.
Fallout. All episodes available now on Prime Video.
Life in our modern age comes at you pretty fast, which makes our time away especially valuable. When I take time to relax, I like to get far from my everyday life, immerse myself in natural beauty, and have unique experiences. But you don't have to leave the U.S. to experience tropical rainforests and islands filled with adventure, warm culture, and national treasures. Visit Puerto Rico, an island with a vibrant spirit that will sweep you away. Because when you visit, you don't become part of the island, it becomes part of you. In Puerto Rico, you can forget where you came from and embrace where you are. Puerto Rico, where visits end, but stories last forever. No passport required for U.S. citizens and permanent residents. Learn more and plan your trip at discoverpuertorico.com.
Welcome to Stuff You Should Know, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Josh, and there's Chuck, and we're doing it today like we're brothers, because this is Stuff You Should Know.
Okay, but we don't make out.
That was my point. I was letting everyone know that we don't make out.
Yeah, I was hoping you were not going to ask me where this idea came from, because I honestly can't remember.
Oh, I thought you were going to say you prefer not to say.
No, I remember Livia helped us with this one, and she did a great job. Yeah, this is outstanding. But I remember sending the email, but I don't remember what happened just before I sent that email.
All I remember is that email was frantic and in all caps with a lot of misspellings.
I had gone to lunch with my super hot cousin. I don't think that had anything to do with it, though.
Cousin Rhonda?
Oh, you know Rhonda.
Everybody knows Rhonda.
There is no cousin Rhonda, just so everyone knows. That was a Josh joke. I don't have many cousins. Do you have a lot of cousins?
I don't know.
Perfect. I was just kind of thinking about this, and I just don't have many. My dad had one brother, and he had three sons, one of whom passed away a few years ago. The other two I'm not close to, or not even touch with, actually. My mom's sister never had kids. Her brother never had biological kids, but I'm actually closest to my cousin David, who you met in our show in Kansas.
Oh, yeah.
David was adopted, and I'm like tighter with him than anyone.
Sure.
And then my mom's other brother has two daughters and a son who seemed great. I just, you know, we were sort of in touch when I was on Facebook, but we kind of fell out of touch over the years. But, you know, they're good people.
Is that Rhonda's family?
That's Rhonda. But I'm not one of these families that has, like, you know, 20-something cousins.
Yeah, I seem to remember as a child in Ohio having, like, a bunch of cousins, but it's not clear as an adult, like, if they were, like, you know, close friends of my mom's kids or that kind of thing. I know I have one cousin who's, like, in his 70s. It's just all over the place. It's a big mess, basically.
Gotcha.
I'm not going to marry any of them. I'm already married, and Yumi and I are verified not cousins.
Correct.
But as we'll see, it's not that big of a deal, at least with cousins, depending on where you are.
Absolutely. And I don't remember what inspired this, but I looked into it a little bit before sending it off to Livia and found that, generally speaking, around the world through history and now, marrying cousins in most of the world is fine.
Yeah, they're cool with it. They like it. And there's good reasons, too. But if we're talking about, so that is, I actually saw a distinction here. So that is what would be called a consanguineous marriage.
Second cousin or closer, right?
Yes, exactly. Right. And that sanguine or is like blood, right? So you're saying like it's a related blood or blood relative marriage is essentially what that is.
Right.
Again, it depends on just how close you're going. People can be cool with it, but there is a definite stopping point. Almost around the world, in every culture, and not just the ones around today, but in throughout history, there's basically been a general taboo on you having sexual relations with your nuclear family. That's siblings, parents, sons, daughters, all that stuff. That when you're that close, you just should not be touching improperly.
Right. As Hodgman would say, hugging and kissing.
Sure.
That's his that's his stand-in for intercourse.
I know. It makes me more uncomfortable than if he just said sex.
That's the thing he says, that is not his real life, application.
That's just as far as he'll go. No one's ever gotten past first base with Hodgman.
Oh, it's so sad. So Livia did a pretty smart thing, I think, with this research and started out with animals, because you would, if you want to look at our primate friends and other mammals, it's kind of a fun place to start. Mm-hmm. And generally speaking, animals also avoid interbreeding. And it depends on which species as to how kind of hardline they are about it and how much they try to avoid it.
Right.
And how much they try to avoid it seems to be entirely based on, because, they're not one to say like, ooh, that's gross, that's creepy. Mm-hmm. Some animals might, but most don't. But it's entirely based on what's called inbreeding depression. Basically, like, will it be bad for our species if we do this?
Yes. So, anthropologists said, well, we're studying animals, and animals show sexual aversion to siblings or parents. So if animals do it and humans are animals, like, does that just mean that all of these cultural taboos around the world and throughout history are basically the human version of innate sexual aversion tendencies that any animal would have? That it's just the kind of the natural evolution of this biological imperative to not reproduce with our parents or siblings.
That's right. But what have they found?
Well, I mean, that's one very widely believed theory, that's what it is. Other people have said, well, I think instead that what it is humans are smart enough to see that there is a problem with, inbreeding, as we'll see later on, that the offspring can have, problems that other offspring of non-cosanguineous marriages wouldn't have. So mm-hmm. we just observed this over time and made up these laws around it to make it taboo for that reason. That's another theory.
Right, which, one of the people that put this forth is a gentleman named William Durham. And it seems like he's saying, like, otherwise, we would be doing this, right?
I guess so, maybe, yeah.
Okay. Oh, I don't want to put words in his mouth, but it just seems like the theory is basically that, like, no, when it comes to humans, there is no natural aversion, but we just sort of invented this thing for good reasons.
But based on observations of, we tried it at first and it didn't really work out. So now we're seeing, like, we need to make some sort of universal law that can extend through the ages, because a taboo is a lot more than just a law. It's like, it's a law plus, what I'm saying? There's like there's this guy named Jonathan Haidt. He used to be with University of Virginia. I don't know if he is still or not, but he was studying moral intuition. And one of the ways that he studied that is he would present study participants with this little scenario where I think it was Julie and Jack, maybe, our brother and sister. They're traveling mm-hmm. together in the mm-hmm. south of France. They're in a cabin one day, and they decide...
This is starting to feel like a penthouse letter.
Oh, buckle up, buddy. They decide just to have a new experience that neither one has ever had and probably never will have again, to have sex.
Okay.
Even though they're blood, brother, and sister, okay?
Okay.
So he puts a spin on this. He says, Julie was on the pill, Jack wore a condom, they both decided that they wanted to see how interesting this would be and that it wasn't going to harm anybody. There was no chance of producing offspring. And they kept this as a secret to themselves that actually brought them closer together as brother and sister to have this shared secret. They never did it again. Is that okay? And to a person, people respond with, no, that's not okay. And Jonathan Haidt would say, why not? And people couldn't put their finger on it.
Right.
They just knew it was wrong.
Just because.
Yeah. And there's been a lot of questions about that. It's like, what study group are you talking about? What does that really show? But it's a really kind of an interesting demonstration that,
totally.
Yeah, we have this really distinct feeling basically across the board, at least, you know, in most cultures, in most societies, that is wrong. There's something very wrong with it, even if we can't overtly say what's wrong with it.
Even if there are wine coolers involved.
Yeah. That's funny you say that, because I just saw a Seinfeld episode where George tries to come on to his cousin.
Oh, really?
To upset his parents, and his cousin is drinking wine coolers in the back of the van right before they're about to do
Wow.
it.
Wow. Yeah. That's really funny.
Yeah.
Totally weird. Yeah. And it very much dates Seinfeld and myself, I guess.
For sure.
Although all those like new fangled alcoholic beverages, those are all just sort of the new wine cooler, aren't they?
Exactly. Yeah.
All right. So we should talk about the Westermarck effect. This is pretty interesting. There was a late 19th century sociologist from Finland named Edvard Westermarck. I guess I should have said the Westermarck effect. And there was a hypothesis that makes a lot of sense that basically said two kids that are raised together won't be sexually attracted to each other as they, you know, when they get older. And then that was expanded to that also includes like parents in the house, and studies have backed this up. And then later it was even expanded further to be like, you don't have to even be related. If you were raised together, then you're not going to be attracted to each other later.
Right. And so that really supports the idea that our cultural taboos against incest is from a biological imperative.
Right.
That there's some part of growing up and reaching adolescence where some mechanism is triggered along the way, or it's like, I'm not attracted to you. You're my sibling kind of thing. And there's plenty of studies that back this up, actually. I think more often than not, the studies tend to back it up, although there have been studies that kind of showed the opposite, but they're so few and far between that it seems like the Westermarck effect is possibly a real thing. And it extends beyond blood relatives, so that kids who are raised together that might not even be blood siblings but are raised in the same house, or say like on a kibbutz, they found that it's also a parent as well, they will have that same Westermarck effect too.
Right. But they also found that it only, because I was going to make a joke about like Willis and Kimberly, but it wouldn't apply because it seems to only be a thing if they were cohabitating before they were 6 years old, which would not be the case with Willis and Kimberly.
No. And explains so everything.
They could they could fall in love. There is also this thing called, well, I don't even think it has a name actually. But just sort of like the backward version of the Westermarck effect, which is, and I feel like I've heard real life stories about this, unless it's just been in TV shows and movies, is when kind of like separated at birth situations where they meet each other later and have a very strong physical attraction to one another.
Yeah. So they're actually.
But then they find out they're cousins and, or maybe even siblings or first cousins, and then it's like, oh, in the movie version. But then they eventually find out that, of course, it was just a big mistake, and they are really in love, and it's okay.
Hooray, they can hug and kiss, finally.
Right, which, well, I was about to say the Royal Tannenbaums, but they were actually raised together, yeah, so that kind of flies in the face of Westermarck.
I think they were actually, oh, no.
She was adopted.
Yeah, that's right. So there actually is a term for this. It's called genetic sexual attraction. And it's not just in movies, dude. There's this really interesting government handout. You can go search the Cumbria, C-U-M-B-R-I-A, City Council, Genetic Sexual Attraction. It'll bring up a PDF that they give to people who have been adopted who are going to reunite with family members that says, hey, we really want to tell you about this really strange experience that you might have where you find you are powerfully attracted to your biological mom who you're just meeting, or your biological sister or brother.
Yeah.
And that, yes, it's very weird and it's going to make you feel weird, but don't follow it through to its, you know, seemingly logical conclusion of having sex with them, because you're going to ruin your lives. You're going to put a strain on this new relationship. And it's not really, you're not really sexually attracted, we think. We think that it's just such a powerful, like connection that you're sensing, that as an adult, you accidentally mistranslated into a sexual attraction, because that's the only thing it could possibly explain. It just does not compute.
Right.
But it's really, really interesting. And it does seem to be a real thing that you have to like take into account when you reunite with a biological family member.
Where is Cumbria? And why Cumbria?
I'm just going to leave that. It is in the UK.
Oh, okay.
I'm pretty sure. Does it matter? They've got a great handout.
No, I just wondered if it was an especially problem, like a problem there, especially, or
doesn't it seem like?
I don't know.
Oh, I see. Yeah, definitely. Maybe it is just a Cumbria problem. I don't know. I got the impression that it was, you know, genetic or biological.
Well, no, I mean that it happened there a lot, so they're like, I guess we need a pamphlet now.
Right. It's a well done pamphlet too.
Or maybe they have a. Well, never mind. I'm just going to drop that one.
I think that's best.
In fact, maybe we should just take a break.
I think that's best as well.
And I'm going to think about what I almost did.
I am the ferryman.
In the shadows of the afterlife, the ferryman of souls guides America's most influential spirits to their eternal rest.
You've been looking for me, yeah?
Where are you taking me?
Are you death?
This road is not on any map.
How much for a ticket?
All I ask for in payment is a tale.
These are the tales that shaped the nation.
I don't know who got to Kennedy first.
And the devastation those first bombs caused.
Then I told them they were drinking cyanide.
Featuring the voices of Wes Studi.
At least 4,000 people died on the trail.
Martin Starr.
President Nixon called me the most dangerous man in America.
Scott Hayes.
Next thing I know, I'm standing over the bodies of Baker Morton, my pistol smoking in my hand.
And Tristan Mack Wilds.
I've never been to hell, but I know intimately the hymns of the damned.
Starring Dan Fogler as the ferryman.
This is The Passage.
Listen to The Passage now. On the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Every family has skeletons in their closet. Mine certainly does. Ones that go back 100 years and reach thousands of miles back to our hometown in Sicily. Ever since I can remember, my relatives told the story of my great-great-grandmother who was killed by the mafia. I'm Joe Piazza, and in my new podcast, I'm taking on a generational vendetta, visiting the scene of the crime, confronting mafia experts, tracking down Italian officials, and even consulting mediums to set the record straight on my great-great-grandmother's mysterious disappearance. And in between the fact-finding missions, I'll be drinking a lot of wine and eating all of the pasta. Come to Italy with me to solve this 100-year-old murder mystery. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. It is 2024, and we're going to get through this together, folks. My campaign promise to all of you here on Next Question is going to be a good time the whole time, we hope. I have some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring Kris Jenner, who's got some words of wisdom for me on being a good grandmother, or in her case, a good lovey.
You know, you start thinking of what you want your grandmother name to be. Like, are they going to call me grandma like I called my grandmother? So I got to choose my name, which is now Lovey.
I'll also be joined by Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, to name a few. So come on in and take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood.
I loved it. Your energy and joy.
I'm squeezing every minute I can for you out of this season of Next Question.
Last question, I promise. You have to go. I have to go. But it's been so fun, and I can't wait for you to hear it. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right. So I guess if we want to, that was a pretty good setup, I think. I think if we want to go back in time, it gets pretty interesting because depending on where you are in the history of humans and where you are on planet Earth, it's sort of gone from people didn't really do it. Some people did. Some people frowned upon it, or generally nobody really frowned upon it for a little while. I guess you could even almost classify it as a fad in some cases.
Sure.
But if you look at religion, certainly throughout time, there are all kinds of interfamily sexual unions from Zeus and Hera, who were siblings, all over Muslim and Jewish and Christian traditions. You know, there's an explanation due when Adam and Eve have Cain and Abel and then sort of look around at each other and go, well, wait a minute, we're supposed to populate the earth.
Right.
So various religions have explained that away as there were also twin daughters born, and that's how the earth was originally populated. And maybe Cain even slew Abel because I guess he got the hot one.
Right. I want Mythy.
Yeah. It sounds like a Monty Python sketch or something.
It really does.
There's this classic Princess Beauty, and then like, in fact, I think that was a Monty Python sketch.
Probably. I don't know the one, but I'm guessing.
Yeah.
So the thing is that they have found, most historians tend to agree, that even though like deities or, you know, ancient figures in religious texts were involved in incest, that among common everyday people, they were not. It was not a widespread phenomenon. It was almost relegated to the elite. By almost, I mean it absolutely was. It's not like if you were an elite family, you were definitely engaged in incest, no matter what culture or what historical period you were in. But you are far more likely in history to, if you were an elite, to have an incestuous relationship than if you were just an everyday schmo cutting stones to build a pyramid.
Yeah, and you know, it's the same as what we'll talk about royals later on. It was a way to keep it all in the family and keep that power consolidated. And we'll see evidence of economic reasons for doing that, as well as just sort of being the elite ruling class. And in fact, in some cases with the elite ruling class, they touted it as like, sort of like we're this special that we are almost required to do this.
I mean, not just above the law, above the taboos.
Yeah.
Like that is, yes, they are definitely creating an elite status for themselves. And it does, like it's definitely been shown, scientifically documented now, that all of these kind of folklore and histories and religious texts are being proven. Like Tutankhamun's parents have been shown to have been brother and sister. Based on histories, we're pretty sure Cleopatra married both of her brothers at different times and that her parents were probably brother and sister. So it definitely did happen. Just to what extent is unclear.
That's right. And I think there was one exception as far as the commoners go, and that was during the Roman Egyptian period, first to third century CE, where I guess that might have been a fad thing because the census shows that there were a lot of common people that were in, you know, sibling marriages, basically.
Yeah, but we don't know what everybody thought of that, but if it was that widespread, I guess people weren't that down on it, you know?
Right.
And then in Iran or Persia at the time, Zoroastrian Persia, from the 5th century BCE to the 11th century CE, they had something called exwadota, which basically said this is a really spiritual, powerful ritual you can engage in on a Friday night with your brother or sister. Right. And that they said that you get a lot of power spiritually from this act, and they think possibly it's because you were having to overcome, you know, your aversion to incest, and supposedly you gained some power from that.
That's right. And it wasn't necessarily like a marriage, right?
No, it was like ritual sex.
Sure. Like Aleister Crowley style.
Exactly. In the desert.
So that's generally like what we've kind of been talking about is sibling stuff and how that's gone through history. When it comes, like we said at the beginning, when it comes to cousins, that's really a different story even today in many parts of the world. cousins, I mean, not from the beginning of time, because it is interesting that they did studies of ancient people and found DNA evidence. And this is just last year in 2021, from almost 1800 ancient humans going back about 45,000 years, or at least as far back as that. Only 3%, it looked like, were even cousin marriage. So it's something that got more popular after ancient humans, which I think is really interesting.
Yeah, they think it started around the time that history did, which is usually where we place, you know, a thousand or 2 years after agriculture. And they think that it was a result of agriculture, of settling down, that you would have a much greater aversion to marrying your cousin in hunter-gatherer societies because there would be much less genetic diversity. But when you take a bunch of different people and pool them into the same place, yeah, they might be related by marriage or, you know, their cousins a couple times removed, but because of the increased genetic diversity, there would be far less chance of there being some sort of genetic mishap from the mating of those cousins.
Yeah, and I guess one thing we didn't point out is that previous to this, when people were engaging in like the elites and sibling marriage and things like that, they generally avoided genetic mishaps because, as you'll see, it's still pretty rare. We'll get to that later, but they did things to discourage that kind of stuff. Like some of the marriages were celibate and stuff like that. And it was really all about consolidation of power and not like, all right, now we'll have 12 kids.
Right, exactly. With eight heads.
This one stat kind of alarmed me, though, and this is, of course, just one person's opinion, but there's an anthropologist at Rutgers named Robin Fox who estimated that 80% of all marriages in history may have been second cousin or closer, which that seems really high.
Yes, but they make a really good case, and they say that until we had segways and trains and stuff like that, when you went courting, you probably didn't court much more than about 5 miles away from home.
Sure.
Because you had to walk there and back, usually in a day. So within that 5 mile radius, you were much more likely to encounter cousins. And so as a result, the cousin marriage probably was like taking place at a really high rate. I don't know where they came up with 80%, but
seems like a lot.
It's a pretty interesting hypothesis, at least.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're going to jump around sort of all over the world too to see what has happened in other cultures. And China is one that's pretty noteworthy in that for a lot of China's, in fact, most of their history, if you were first cousins and you wanted to get married, it was generally okay unless they were the kids of two male siblings and they just reckoned because you had the same family name, it was a little too weird.
They thought that brothers with the same family name were kind of considered more relatives than, say, a brother and a sister with two different last names because the sister's been married off.
Which is just not true.
No, it's not. But, I mean, it's a cultural thing, you know?
Yeah. But this also came about in the early 80s with the PRC marriage law banning first cousin marriage. And it was about birth defects, and it was the same time as sort of their, I don't know what, I mean, do we call it eugenics?
They said that they wanted to improve, quote, the quality of the population. So, yeah, I'd say that's eugenics.
Okay. But it was in lockstep with the one-child policy, and that's basically when China started getting, like, super in everyone's business.
Yeah.
As far as child rearing goes.
But what's interesting is that's about 100 years after America started passing laws on that kind of thing, too.
Yeah, that's true.
So there's another, there's a really cool hypothesis by a guy named Joseph Heinrich, who's an evolutionary biologist. And he traces a really big change back to 506 CE, when the Catholic Church, the people leading the church basically said, hey, you cannot marry anyone closer than your third cousin from now on, which is interesting because we consider a co-sanguineous relationship. Second cousins are closer, right? So maybe that's where that comes from. But they are not entirely certain why they said that, but they said that, and it was a big-time rule. And the Catholics started running the show around that time all over Europe. So this applied to a lot of people. And Heinrich's hypothesis is that that changed things so much that it led to the modern world, basically.
Right, with the idea that, I guess the family bonds took a hit. Mm-hmm. People were encouraged to be a little more individualistic. I don't know why I put a big pause in the middle of that. Mm-hmm. And basically trust other people such that societies were able to form, because it wasn't like, well, I only trust my family. You know, they started, it really came down to human trust, mm-hmm. as far as branching out, mm-hmm. and larger groups of non-related people kind of getting along and trusting each other.
Yeah, because if you only trust and care for and take care of your kin, you know, a kin network can only be so large. So your society can only be so large. But if you remove that kind of kin network stuff, like by saying you need to marry outside of your kin network, then you can support a larger and larger society too. And then they think also that led to things like free market competition, that we might not have had that or right. such an emphasis on that kind of thing. Or like you said, individualism, that it basically, whatever we think of as the West today traces its roots back to that. And it all had to do with not being able to marry members of your kin group.
Which is the opposite of the Josh Clark motto, which is never trust family.
Exactly.
Another little sidebar here that I thought was interesting was the some people think that the tradition at a wedding of saying if anyone has any objections to the marriage is sort of a evolution of the question, does anybody know if these two are related?
Yeah, I thought that was amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Heinrich wrote a book, if you're like, I need to know more about this, it's called How the West Became Weird. Weird as in Western, educated, industrialized, rich, and democratic.
Right, not yeah. Austin weird.
No, but I think he also says like kind of Austin weird too, you know?
Oh, okay.
So we talked about, you know, when people think of like incest and royalties, or even, intra-family marriage, like you tend to think of things like the Habsburg jaw. And I know we've talked about that before, but I don't remember. Did we do like a short stuff on it or something?
No, I tried to think of it. I think I'm pretty sure it was a video, one of our videos that we did, because I remember flashing images of these humongous underbites.
Chuck, I swear to you, we've talked about it in the last year.
Really?
Yes, I swear. And either that or my sense of time has been so messed up in the last couple of years that
well,
I'm just done, basically.
Right. So the Habsburgs were royals who inbred so much that they had, like you said, what was known as the Habsburg jaw. Mm-hmm. And what I said, which was a big time underbite. And like I have a bit of a even bite, not quite an underbite. Mm-hmm. And I've always been a little self-conscious about it, but when I saw the Habsburg jaws, I was not.
You're like, I got nothing to worry about. Yeah, Charles II of Spain was described as, quote, swallowing all he eats whole, for his nether jaw stands out so much that his two rows of teeth cannot meet.
Yeah.
That's the Habsburg jaw for you. I'm pretty sure you can chew your food, right?
No, I'm fine. I'm a little more Bruce Springsteen, not quite Habsburg.
So the much bigger problem that the Habsburg faced is that their children had an infant mortality rate of about 18%,
yeah,
which was high even at the time, but it was specific for that family. And what they were doing, I think you touched on it earlier, was they were consolidating power. They were making sure that some other family from some other country didn't worm its way into the Habsburgs and take over Germany or Saxony or Austria, wherever the Habsburgs were ruling. And they just kept it in the family. And so there were some problems genetically. But they were far from the only family to try this. And some of the greatest economic dynasties that the world has ever seen did the same thing for the same reasons, too.
Yeah, the DuPonts, Pierre Samuel DuPont, said in 1810, quote, "The marriages that I should prefer for our colony would be between the cousins, and that way we should be sure of honesty of soul and purity of blood," end quote. And that was, you know, it's not only about power, but I think keeping the money in the family.
Yes.
Being wary of strangers coming in because they're rich, that kind of thing. So I think it was, at least how I read it, was a little less like a eugenics pure bloodline thing and a little more like we got to keep our own.
Yes, and it was the same thing for the Rothschild, the Jewish banking family. It basically the exact same thing. And so the DuPonts, which were founded, I believe, in France, DuPont's first name was Pierre Samuel back in 1810. The Rothschild I know were, I believe, in France. I know, I believe they were from France. And the Habsburgs basically ruled Europe for, you know, quite a while, centuries, I believe. And so in Europe, the idea of intra-family marriages and inbreeding between close relations was kind of looked at as like, if you were well-to-do, you kind of did that thing. So there wasn't nearly as much an aversion to it as there was in the United States, which is why the United States was one of the first countries to really start passing laws against marrying close relations, actually.
Yeah, 1875 is when things started to kind of, I think people just started to not do it as much culturally in the U.S. And then as far as laws on the books, it even started a little bit before that. And what was the very first state, Josh?
Kansas.
Yeah, leading, the Jayhawks.
Leading the way in incest laws.
That's, don't do it. In 1858 and by the mid-1920s, most of the states had laws on the books. Olivia points out that if you were a Western state, you were a little more likely to be ahead of the curve because they were newer states and they were just writing their laws for the first time. So they kind of, you know, had to go through everything.
Right.
And this was a time when everyone in the country just started looking at the laws around marriages basically in a health and safety manner and not so much like we just want to be in your business thing.
Right. And it's strange to think of today, and especially as an American, but apparently America has long had an outlier preoccupation with like close relatives marrying. Like mm-hmm. elsewhere in the world, as we'll see, it's not a thing. But even in parts of Europe, it's a much more modern aversion than it has been in America. Like, I guess around the world, we're known as like, we got a real problem with cousin marrying, like almost like methinks they doth protest too much. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I know what you mean. 25 states in the U.S. today have banned first cousin marriage. Only half. Seven more have some restrictions. And I think Arizona's is,
I love it,
fairly adorable because they allow it if you're both at least 65 years old or older, mm-hmm. Or if you can't reproduce. So I guess they're like, you know, I guess you really couldn't find anyone else.
Or you really, really loved each other. Just don't make any babies. That's the Arizona law.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, and again, we're talking co-sanguineous marriages. In most laws, that means second cousins or closer. And again, around the world, this is not considered a problem. That cousin marriages, apparently as much as 10% of the global population practice marriages of second cousins or closer. And then in some Middle Eastern provinces, it's as high as 80%.
Yeah. And it's interesting when you look at this, I guess it was a study. They were interviews in Pakistan in 1995 around this. And the reasons that these women gave were, they make a lot of sense. They said that a few different things, that they were more compatible. Not compatible, compatible.
Sure.
With family than strangers, which makes sense.
Yeah.
That their in-laws were kinder to the brides if they were from the same family. Mm-hmm. And that if you had a co-sanguineous marriage, you were less focused on physical appearance and looks.
Yeah, that was the Pakistani surveys respondents like take on the whole thing, that they just didn't consider it like that. And then the other thing is they were suspicious of people who wanted to marry outside their family, because in a society like that, where there was a lot of intra-marriage or intra-family marriages, it was a real red flag when somebody outside of your family was like, hey, you want to marry me? Because it would say that their family found them unfit to be married. So they've got real problems, right? So, yeah. You would just not want to marry something like that in that sense.
Shall we take a break?
Yeah, let's.
All right. We'll talk about some more famous examples and then get to the bottom of the health risks right after this.
I am the ferryman.
In the shadows of the afterlife, the Ferryman of Souls guides America's most influential spirits to their eternal rest.
You've been looking for me, yeah?
Where are you taking me?
Are you death?
This road is not on any map.
How much for a ticket?
All I ask for in payment is a tale.
These are the tales that shaped the nation.
I don't know who got to Kennedy first.
And the devastation those first bombs caused.
Then I told them they were drinking cyanide.
Featuring the voices of Wes Studi.
At least 4,000 people died on the trail.
Martin Starr.
President Nixon called me the most dangerous man in America.
Scott Hayes.
Next thing I know, I'm standing over the bodies of Baker Morton. My pistol smoking in my hand.
And Tristan Mack Wilds.
I've never been to hell, but I know intimately the hymns of the damned.
Starring Dan Fogler as the ferryman.
This is The Passage.
Listen to The Passage now. On the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robey,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Hello. From Wonder Media Network, I'm Jenny Kaplan, host of Womanica, a daily podcast that introduces you to the fascinating lives of women history has forgotten. This month, we're bringing you the stories of disappearing acts. There's the 17th century fraudster who convinced men she was a German princess, the 1950s folk singer who literally drove off into the sunset and was never heard from again, the First Nations activist whose kidnapping and murder ignited decades of discourse about Indigenous women's disappearances, and the young daughter of a Russian czar whose legendary escape led to even more intrigue and speculation. These stories make us consider what it means to disappear and why a woman might even want to make herself scarce. Listen to Womanica on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I never thought I'd take my three young kids to Sicily to solve a century-old mystery, but that's what I'm doing in my new podcast, The Sicilian Inheritance. Join us as we travel thousands of miles on the beautiful and crazy island of Sicily, as I trace my roots back through a mystery for the ages and untangle clues within my family's origin story, which has morphed like a game of telephone through the generations. Was our family matriarch killed in a land deal gone wrong? Or was it by the Sicilian mafia? A lover's quarrel? Or was she, as my father believed, a witch? Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
So, Chuck, before we get started again, I want to say something because I came across a working definition of incest is way different than the just kind of the general way that we're using it. And I've tried to pepper this with, you know, intramarriage or consanguineous marriage, but incest specifically, which most people just think of as like sexual relations between very close family members, is supposedly defined as like it's a dominant version of that. It's an abusive version of that, where somebody in a position of power, like an older brother or an older sister or a father or mother, basically molests like one of their family members. It's a very specific kind of sexual relations among family members, and probably the darkest of all the kinds.
So that's the true definition?
That's what I saw.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
I always thought that it could also mean consensual.
Yeah, I think that's what most people think. That's why I wanted to share that, because that's what I thought, too, until, you know, yesterday when I was running across it.
All right. Thanks for clearing that up.
You're welcome.
So let's talk about the elephant in the room, which is the health risks. Mm-hmm. That's sort of the unspoken thing people always think about in the back of their head when they hear of like, oh, I have family members that married each other and they're third cousins. And the very first thing that probably pops into someone's head is like, is this going to be problematic when they go to have kids? And as we will see, that doesn't necessarily mean that it will.
Isn't that astounding? Right? Yeah.
Yeah.
It's crazy. Like, my entire view of this thing has been completely upended in the last 2 days because it depends on, well, we'll get into it in a second. But when most people think of, like, close relations marrying, you just think of children born with abnormalities, birth defects, possibly genetic disorders, and all that can happen. But the reason it happens isn't because brother and sister, you know, had sex and automatically God punished them, you know?
Right.
That's not how it works. What it is that brother and the sister are much more likely to be carriers of a certain recessive gene. And so when you put those two together and produce an offspring, that offspring is almost certainly going to have that genetic disorder or abnormality or whatever. And so that's just likelier to happen. But even among intramarriages or intrafamily marriages, that's a really rare outcome, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, these genetic disorders that we're talking about, which are everything from sickle cell anemia to cerebral palsy, I guess cystic fibrosis, some of these things, they're rare to begin with. Mm-hmm. So even if you're doubling up your chances, it's not like it makes it likely. It's still going to be rare.
Right.
And it's the case where, like, this is the thing that reveals that recessive gene,
mm-hmm.
you know, because the brother and the sister don't have this disease. That's why it's recessive.
Right.
So they don't know this going in. And then all of a sudden they have a kid that has this birth defect and they maybe do genetic testing and it's unraveled.
Right. So the thing is, that can happen to two non-related people too.
Sure.
Because there's so many recessive genes out there in the general population. But because there's so many and there's so many people, that the chances of two unrelated people is much less. Like you said, it might be double for people who are related, but still in absolute terms, it's not that much of a risk.
Right.
Numbers-wise. But what you're saying is when you get to non, like if you're not marrying a family member, you're actually engaging in more of a genetic crapshoot than you are as a marrying a family member because you could know probably what's likelier to happen. Unless you've done, like you said, genetic counseling, you have no idea how your genes are going to match with somebody else's. Again, we have so many genes, there's so many different possible mutations, and there's so many people in the reproductive pool that the chances are just very low that it's going to produce some sort of genetic disorder or abnormality or something like that.
Yeah, and I think historically it's been a lot more common in very small rural communities where the gene pool period is just a lot smaller.
Right.
And it's just math, basically. You're just going to be more at risk.
Okay, so I read this this study. Well, I read the abstract. I have to fess up. I didn't read the whole study. But it was from the University of Natural Sciences, Lahore in Pakistan. And they basically said, whether cosanguineous or non-cosanguineous marriage, which one is preferable depends on which level you're looking on the individual level or on the population level. And that on a population level, and this is stone cold eugenic speak, right? So I just want to preface it with that. But on a population level, you're actually better off having your population marry relatives because there will be a huge upsurge initially in children who are born with, genetic disorders, who might not survive infancy, and who won't go on to reproduce. The ones who do survive and go on to reproduce will actually be potentially genetically fitter because their good alleles, their good genes, mixed with their sister's good genes, and they're producing offsprings with like super genes, basically. So on a population level, it's great. On an individual level, it's not so great.
Interesting.
And so they concluded overall for populations, until we learn to treat genetic disorders, like through gene therapy or something like that, we should really just keep outlawing cosanguineous marriages.
Right. Wow. When was that?
It was a recent paper. I'm not exactly sure, but it was in the last 10 years for sure.
Well, should we finish up with just some bulleted points and factoids?
That's how we do.
Well, I guess we could talk about some famous people who very famously married very close relatives.
Mm-hmm.
Edgar Allan Poe did so. In 1835, he married, I believe, a first cousin named Virginia Eliza Clem.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently the outrage there was the fact that she was 13.
Right.
And he was 27. So even in 1835, that was a pretty big age gap. And I guess people were creeped out. And I guess Poe's walking around super creepy anyway.
Sure. He was like, what can I do to creep people out further?
Yeah, exactly.
Jesse James married his first cousin in 1874, which, again, it's right on the precipice of when America started to be like, we're not cool with cousin marrying anymore.
Oh, yeah. That's right there, isn't it?
H.G. Wells, 1891.
Yeah.
And then Einstein. I didn't know he married his cousin. Did you?
I did not know that. Married his cousin Elsa in 1919. And I think both of them, it was their second time around, mm-hmm. marriage-wise. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't think it went so well. I think he wasn't a great husband, apparently.
Yeah. So Olivia found all that's an interesting article that's really depressing and disturbing because I had no idea, but Einstein seems to have been a really terrible husband, like cruel even, you could say.
Yeah.
Yeah. So if you really want to just keep liking Einstein and only think of him like that poster with his tongue sticking out, right, do not read that All That Is Interesting article on it.
Or a lovable Shaggy Tim Robbins.
Yeah. What was that from?
Oh, he was in the movie. Meg Ryan played his daughter.
No, that was Walter Matthau that played Einstein.
Oh. She got together with Tim Robbins. That's right.
Tim Robbins got another good 20 years before he starts playing Einstein.
Yeah, or Meg Ryan's dad. I was way confused. Matthau, he was a great Einstein.
Oh, man, he was great.
Most lovable
Einstein.
Did
you ever see The Couch Trip with Dan Aykroyd? Him?
Sure. I'm a big Walter Matthau fan.
That was a wonderful movie, and I think that might be one of his better performances, too.
Yeah, he was amazing. What can we go over here? Some other sort of taboos around the world? These are interesting, I think.
Yeah, I agree. So different cultures have kind of come up with, like, taboo plus, like really complex stuff to basically say, mm-hmm. okay, you can marry this person, you can't marry that person. It goes beyond just you can't marry your second cousin or closer. And one of the ways that the Muslim religion has done this is to come up with something called a milk kinship, where if you breastfeed a child who's unrelated to you at least 3 to 5 times, then you and that child are considered mahram, which means you cannot marry, right? Even though you're not a blood relative, you might not have any blood shared between you because you breastfed, you can't marry that person.
Right, which seems like, duh, because you're raising this, you know, kid from a baby. But I don't think we mentioned at the beginning, there have been cultures through history where it was a common practice to adopt and raise a baby and also marry them. Like, you marry the baby and then raise them up to adulthood.
Baby bride.
It's very hard to wrap your head around.
Or baby groom, I saw in at least one culture.
Yeah. Again, it's hard to wrap your head around here in 2022, but that's something that happened. So this was a big deal in the Muslim culture because you don't have to wear hijab if you are mahram. So it's sort of a workaround when you raise this adopted baby. It all of a sudden, when they get old enough, you don't have to wear that hijab around them anymore.
Right, right. Because you're mahram, which is kind of fun to say.
It is.
And then there's something called the levirate marriage. I think it has to do with Levi from the Bible, Old Testament stuff. But basically, it's a law that is found in a bunch of different disparate cultures that says if you are married to a man and your husband dies, your brother-in-law has to marry you.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to have been a way not to, you know, marry off an unmarriable brother, a brother-in-law, I should say, but instead to take care of women, from what I can tell.
Yeah, I feel like I've seen this not as a requirement, but as just a plot line in like Old West movies.
Mm.
Like the husband dies, and so the widow marries his, you know, the brother comes into town for the funeral, and then they fall in love or something.
Is it Tim Robbins?
I think so. He had really shaggy hair. I know I've seen that before, but as far as the Old Testament version, there was a stipulation where if the brother-in-law said, no thanks, Then the widow, I guess in offense, takes off his sandals and then spits in his face. Mm-hmm. And then his bloodline is forever known as the family of the unsandaled.
Which I guess you would not want to be known as that.
I guess so.
I also saw, so there's a culture called the Chukchi from Eastern Siberia, and they practice levirate marriage, where, you know, if your husband dies, you marry his brother. And this is a way of taking care of women in a place that's like really unforgiving climate-wise. And they actually have a backup to that. They have wife swapping, where very close friends will create a pact and they will share their wives. And then all of the children born are all that group's, you know, responsibility. There's not like a delineation. And that supports women whose husbands don't have a brother. So if their husband dies, they're still taken care of by this other husband and his wife and their family.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, it's pretty smart.
I always think of Raising Arizona when I ever hear the two words wife swap.
Yeah, it's impossible not to, you know.
Me and Dottie are swingers.
You got anything else?
I got nothing else.
I don't either, which means this is the end of our marrying cousin episode. Since I talked about marrying cousins one last time, that means it's time for listener mail.
I'm going to call this adoption language, and this is something that made me feel bad in a good way. If that makes sense. Mm-hmm. It's something I never considered as a dad who has an adopted kid, and I'm really glad that Frank opened my eyes to this. Hey guys, my wife Katie and I were listening to the Roe v. Wade episode, and we have a minor tangential note. We noticed that you used the phrase gave up when referencing adoption a few times, mm-hmm. like gave up their baby for adoption, which is, you know, it's a very common thing people say, like sure. I say it all the time too.
Yeah.
My wife is a social worker for an adoption agency in the Chicago area, and I learned from her that the phrase is really frowned upon in the adoption community, as it can have a negative connotation of quitting on a child when that is not the case, and they encourage people to say instead that the mother made an adoption plan for the baby. In fact, her agency had a campaign a few years ago called Give Up, Giving Up. I never thought twice about it until I learned about it from my wife, and I think it'd be great for your listeners to know. And that is from Frank. And Frank, I'm very glad you let me know this, because this is something that we've even said in our house, and we have tidied that up, because when I think about it, that is not the right thing to say.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, you could see it reflecting on the child, especially when they get old enough to start thinking in those terms, but also on the parents who adopted off their child, you know, like they yeah. did something shameful or something like that. Yeah.
I'd absolutely, totally man.
Way to go, yeah. Frank.
So I think it's one of those situations where it's just sort of the way it's always been said. And mm-hmm. I love it when people point out, like, no, there's a better way forward.
Yeah. Like when that dude told us to stop using Dark Ages.
That's right. Same thing.
Yeah. If you want to get in touch with us like Frank or the Dark Ages dude, you can send us an email. Wrap it up, spank it on the bottom, unless it's a second cousin or closer, and send it off to stuffpodcast@iheartradio.com.
Stuff You Should Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Coming back to Atlanta. Right now. Whoa. Mark your calendars, because the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts, but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
I am the ferryman.
In the shadows of the afterlife, the ferryman of souls guides America's most influential spirits to their eternal rest.
Where are you taking me?
Are you death?
This road is not on any map.
How much for a ticket?
All I ask for in payment is a tale.
I don't know who got to Kennedy first.
And the devastation those first bombs caused.
I've never been to hell, but I know intimately the hymns of the damned.
Listen to The Passage now on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Every family has an origin story, one passed down through the generations. Mine happens to be a mystery involving my great-great-grandmother left behind in Sicily. I'm Joe Piazza, and my new podcast will transport you to the gorgeous island of Sicily as I trace my roots back through a whodunit for the ages. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.